April is the cruelest month, breeding lilacs out of the dead land, mixing memory and desire, stirring dull roots with spring rain. Winter kept us warm, covering earth in
Welcome to Ringside, the show where the sacred and profane collide. And today we might have a little more profane than sacred. You are with your host, Ross Engel.
Hey, everybody. How you doing today?
Paul Cox.
Yeah, let's get going. Yes.
Tyler, the intern. And myself, Joel Hess. And what a privilege it is to have you listening to us out there throughout the world, across the globe. It is a privilege. It's an honor. And we hope to not let you down today. We got a lot of great topics. We're going to talk about Jesus' parable, the prodigal sons, and maybe is it possible that the father is not a very good parent because his two sons are jerks? I don't know. We'll see. We'll be talking about other issues similar to that. We got Palm Sunday coming up, and Paul wrote a great article about work, toil, eat, drink, be merry. What does that mean for a Christian, etc.? And communion. Are you getting enough out of your Holy Communion? Is there something you could be doing to appreciate it more? What does it mean to you? Do you just go through it? Should you just have it once a year so you can really appreciate it? We'll talk about that and some other stuff. So, anyhow, but before we do that, this show is brought to you by Zion Williamson and the star of the Duke Blue Devils. And we're going to be talking mostly about where he's going to go to the NBA and how the Duke could possibly have lost and that sort of stuff. Oh. So, yeah.
I saw on ESPN that he passed away on Sunday.
Is that right?
That's why. Yeah. That's the way that they were talking about. I mean, I didn't see the beginning like of it, but it was all right. Like this tribute and like in memoriam to Zion. So I thought he didn't die.
I thought so.
You know, the media never knows what to do when their golden boy loses. So
yeah,
what are you all do I know is when Duke loses, I celebrate.
I think everyone does, don't they?
Yeah, I saw some graphic that like Michigan State is now the favorite team in the Final Four, and people are attributing that to the fact that they beat Duke.
Yeah. Yeah, we could beat him 2 out of 3 times, I'm going to tell you that. Anyhow, is there anybody out there, can you think of whenever you get like a celebrity died and you thought, I thought that they already died?
Oh, yeah.
Have you had that? Yeah. I get that all the time. Something comes across there and so-and-so died, like Gilligan. Who was it? Bob Denver? Is he dead, by the way? I don't know. But you see that, you're like, swear he's been dead for a while.
Wasn't he the one that was doing the concert when we were in Fort Wayne, or was that one of the other old timers?
Bob Denver?
What the heck?
Some old guy that should be dead was doing a concert when we were in Fort Wayne.
John Denver is very much dead.
Yeah. Mr. Sunshine on a shoulder, John Denver.
That's right. Don't drink and fly an airplane. Right.
Maybe it was Bob Seger that was playing.
Is he dead? I don't know. But this is where you would go. If you're wondering, is a particular celebrity dead? I think you dial up Ringside. I think that's the first place I would go.
Oh, totally.
To find that kind of information.
We are the
out,
so. Authority on celebrity deaths.
Yes.
That's right.
That's what I've heard.
So when you are listening to this podcast, you will be entering Holy Week with a strong Palm Sunday. Oh, no, I guess you won't. You'll be looking toward Holy Week coming, won't you? Yeah. But for some, you will, because there's some people out there that do like a double Holy Week or something like that.
Isn't they do every week Holy Week because every Sunday is Easter Sunday?
No. Because we're holy.
Oh,
in
listen
Christ.
To this guy.
Somebody should go to seminary and learn what he already knows. Someone should get 2 bachelor degrees of the exact same courses. Anyhow, so that's our path to pastorhood in the LCMS.
See, I think you guys just need to get accredited, and then I can get a degree from Ringside University.
Whoa, okay.
Oh, now you're talking.
Now we're talking here. Let's get our best people on that and figure that out. Talk to our lawyers if we could. That'd be great.
Tyler, we got to hire a few more people. If Tyler's going to be our only student, we got to get like five more professors to, in order to have the right professor to student ratio. Like and our fine
four of them are in the lab.
That's well, my parents are willing to pay a lot of money to get me in. So
nice.
You guys just figure out what you got to do. And I got it covered on my end. Yeah, I'll be on the ringside.
What do you guys want? You give us each $1 million, and we will let you in the university. Done. There
we go.
Solved. That's called negotiating. Mm. All right. So, first topic. Let's hit this. Actually, where's our bell? Let's hear our bell. Is the bell going? Okay. So, Tyler, this is a huge responsibility. Let's keep up with our Lenten challenge.
Okay.
We have been doing a decent job, so we need that bell to happen on time. And now
I will be
think
on top.
The conversation's over. All right.
Promise.
So let's Ross, I hear noises already.
Yeah, we're trying to put a few in there just today. For you guys to try and guess what it is. Yep.
That game, we're not doing that.
We're not doing that game
that.
Today?
Okay.
You got
a couple people
at.
There. Yes. There is a listener who does not like noises. So freaked her out. So anyhow. might be like a bat. So our first, let's get right after it. Our first topic, we hit the bell and we get through it and we're done. I mean, we can do the whole Bible in 5 minutes if need be. So just sit back. You guys out there listening, you don't need to do anything. You just sit back. Enjoy this. We're going to do all the work. All right. First topic is Paul. You wrote a great article today, quoting Ecclesiastes, mm-hmm. about work. And drinking, and what's the other thing that he says there?
Eating,
yes.
Yeah.
And give us a synopsis of that. If you want to read this, by the way, while you're listening to us, go to thejaggedword.com and check out Paul's recent article. Paul, what's the gist of what you wrote there? Eat, drink, and get to work is the name.
Yeah, so it was a... just reflections. I've been teaching through Book of Ecclesiastes, and one of the great lines in there, it comes up over and again, is that your toil, your lot in life, what you're given to do, is to eat and drink and enjoy your work. And in fact, God says he finds joy in you doing those things. And so your portion, your contribution to the great narrative of history is really, really small. God's the one that's driving it. He's the one that's overseeing the direction of things. And so you're given to do a very small thing. Small sure. in the grand scheme of things, not small necessarily for the benefit of your neighbor, the people that are right around you, your immediate circle. And I guess what I was suggesting is I think this is fundamentally offensive to most Christians because it offends our understanding of or what we want our work and our toil to be. Like we want it to be this glorious thing that will shape and change the future. And God says kind of, right. No, I got that. You just get to work. and
I got that for you.
Yeah, don't worry about it. And so there should be freedom in there. And that's what I was arguing, that there's, it means when I go to work, when I take care of the things I'm given to do, that there's a lot of joy then because it's not like eternity hangs in the balance of my effort, you know. And nor does somebody else's eternity necessarily hang in the balance. That God is still the one; he's still an electing God. He's still a God that chooses and acts in this world, and so it gives me the comfort to just get about my business, to eat, drink, and go to work. So,
right. I like how you say this ought to be good news.
Yeah,
pressure's off. That's fantastic. And then also your sentence, if you lift your head to look beyond your neighbor, beyond the impact of those around you when you work, then you are missing the beauty and joy of this life.
Yeah.
I think that's really good. Do you mean by that looking at big things? So you're not just talking about Christian, you know, working for salvation, like that's a done deal, but just work, you know, in the job is given you, if you're thinking big global changes or something.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of that, right? That we want, again, we want glory in our what we're doing, and And we miss the people that are right around us. And and if we're always looking at the larger scope, I think we miss really a lot of joy, a lot of fun and happiness in our lives, contentment even, by looking always to the bigger and the better things, I guess, or what we perceive to be bigger and better.
Yeah. I absolutely fail at that. Absolutely terrible at that. And you do ruin your day. Yeah. Like Van Gogh, I think, just painted for the hell of it. He didn't get anything for it at all. And well, what am I talking about? He cut his ear off. So I don't know if he wasn't living a joyful life. except for when he drank absinthe. What do you think, Ross?
Well, and I think it's good to be reminded of the contribution that we make to what God is actually actively doing. And it doesn't fly in the face, you know, reading Paul's article, it would be very easy for someone to say, look, he's denying the work of vocation. You know, isn't vocation a big deal for Lutherans? But I think he actually still upholds vocation in pointing out that our life and our effort and deeds aren't much in compared to the work of the Creator. And I like the fact that as he writes, he talks about how sometimes the things we do can be diametrically opposed to God and what he is actively doing. We do get this idea so often that we're important. You know, God can't function without us doing our part. And it's nice to be brought back to the reality that, yes, we're given things to do and tasks to do, but let's not get so self-important that we think that God can't accomplish his purposes without us.
Yeah, right.
You know, even on, and I think we're going to get that in the Palm Sunday reading, right? So Jesus comes in, the Pharisees tell Jesus, hey, tell your disciples to shut up and stop praising you. And he's like, well, if they're silent, the stones will cry out, you know? So even though the disciples are there praising God as Jesus enters Jerusalem, if they weren't doing that, if they had been all like hung over and half asleep, God could have made the stones cry out and still accomplish his purposes. And it's nice sometimes we put into that place.
Okay, let's go on the next topic here. Yeah. And this is related to that. I was talking to a friend there at our Chicago Concordia last week, and talking about this issue of what I would say, and I think Paul brings it out from the Heidelberg Disputation, is a Reformation jewel, and that is, and another recovery, not as big as the gospel, but the importance of domestic vocation, working right where you're at, and that's a holy thing, right? I mean, that's a holy activity. What would you say? I'm going to posit this because of that, and I think that's true. That began a spiral to the world we are today, which I think is some negative, and that is people stopped looking to the heavens as to what they can do, and as the only holy work is doing sort of heavenly work or being a monk or whatever, and now they elevated the domestic life to the point where you've got people just only concerned about the domestic world, making a difference, changing the world. You know, that's such an Enlightenment period idea that really came out of the Reformation, I think, from Luther's, you know, vocation and being a father and dad and working, being a lawyer, whatever it is. These are good things. I wonder to the point where people don't look up anymore, and now they're just looking to make, you know, work hard and make the world better. What do you think about that, Paul?
I don't think it's actually changed all that much. Let's do it this way. I think the desire for glory is the same, whether it was, I'm going to do this kind of for heaven, you know, that kind of thing, or I'm going to do this, you know, for my neighbor. You're still kind of, the temptation is still to get your own glory, your own claim, your own recognition of some sort. And so, I agree that I think there's, we might, maybe let's do it this way, like the cause of the church is lessened over, say, the cause of your individual needs or your personal family or something like that. But I think that the temptation that lurks behind it all, so like the doctrine of vocation was to say, you don't have to go right? Truly godly work wasn't just the work of the church, whether that was paying, you know, money or doing those mm-hmm. kind of things, that it was found in okay. your life as well. And so I think people just can do the same thing going the other way. They can go, well, I'm finding godly work in my life, and then I'm going to ignore like the community, the believers or something like that, mm-hmm. and just care for myself. But I it's the same temptation. I think no matter which direction you're going, is you're trying to find your pathway to glory of some sort. The Heidelberg Disputation, you brought that in. I didn't really mention that, but I did use that in the article, which is, you know, he's just cutting through this, that what you think is great is just not, you know, that it's just not. And God, what looks like terrible stuff from God is quite often the great stuff. You know, these are the eternal merits. And so it's really puts you in a very much a passive role. And I think we rebel fundamentally against that, being in some sort of passive spot.
Right. We hate that. Yeah. We think, Ross.
Well, you know, I think as we look at the culture today, too, there's a big disconnect between what people are doing in relation to, God functioning through them. So, like you said, Joel, people have come to this sort of idea that the only time they're serving God is when they're doing stuff at the church, which then downplays the way they mm-hmm. are, the way God is working through them in their vocation, whether it's, you know, their day-to-day job, their place in the family or the community, to the point that people often work jobs that they're miserable at all week long with the thought that I'm just working this job to make the money I need to do what I want to do on the weekend, or the job is a means to an end, whatever that end might be, which then takes away mm-hmm. the joy of what we do each day and the kind of the role or the way God uses what we do each day as a mask that he hides behind as we serve our neighbors.
Right.
And I think we see that very clearly in the workforce and the labor force today, where people are doing jobs to make money for the purpose of supporting what they want to do on the weekend. I know it's a song from the 80s, but it's true. Everybody does seem to be working for the weekend. Putting up with whatever, you know, job, not seeing it as anything useful or necessarily good, except it provides them the means to do what they want to do. And if we actually are able to find capture the joy in work and the joy in serving others and the joy of our vocations, then it actually allows God to have his proper place, that yes, God is still active among his people in the world, accomplishing his purposes in large ways and in very small, almost unrecognizable ways. And I think we've lost some of that in our culture today.
And I think a lot of that comes from the church itself.
Yes.
I would say the way that the church is and the way that the church elevates, I mean, pastors and like church workers. Well, that's exactly the problem right there. That's why people think that you're more important than them.
You think that
the work of the pastor is more important than the work of them? And I think that's where a lot of it stems from.
Well, in the church it is.
True.
Right.
Ah, okay. Interesting.
In the church it is. Yeah.
That's good.
I mean,
if there's a job that needs to be done, it's the guy preaching. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah.
Everything else is good, important, but I mean, that's what has to be happening.
It's not more God's work than other people's vocations, but
right.
mm-hmm. you know, within the church, I mean, that there's a reason, right? That's the office in the church. I mean, it's
the
more
one
important.
God ordained.
Yeah,
yeah. There actually are no other God ordained offices in the church in that sense. Yeah,
yeah.
All right, let's go on. Okay, hey, that was a good little teaser. Let's go to the parable of the prodigal sons, which I can't stand anymore, right? It's just, people still don't understand this. I preached on this last Sunday, and I believe it blew people's minds as the focus was all on the second son, who was home the whole time, and whatever. Right. But I'm in a new church too, I suppose. So that's what's fun about taking a new call, actually. So the parable of the lost son, or the parable of the prodigal son, or as we like to call it, the parable of the prodigal father, I suppose, or whatever. The guy's got two sons. One, the youngest, takes his inheritance. Just for those listening outside, don't know what I'm talking about. Chapter 15 of Luke 11 through whatever to the end there. And so I'm talking about this yesterday at one of our Bible studies in the morning. And one of the ladies said, brilliantly, because we're talking about this in our own life as parents as well. And she said, you know, maybe the father didn't do a good job. And that's why the son, you know, the second son who kind of saw his relationship with his dad as a working one, a quid pro quo one, you know, where he thought that dad was boss and he was a worker. And that's why dad loved him, because he worked hard, I think. You know what I mean? That he connected all that together. Which is sadder than the other kid who just totally threw it all away. You know, God bless that guy. He's a rock star. But so she's like, maybe did dad not convey this information? Did he, you know what I mean? Did he, maybe he failed. Now, Jesus' point is not to go there. Every parable and every metaphor breaks down, right? But what do you think about that? Ross, you got thoughts? Have you thought about that? Why would both kids, I mean, when you look at two kids screwing up, don't you blame the dad?
You know, it's interesting. You know, when you first mentioned that topic, my immediate thought went to, of course, a human being is going to try and blame the father, because we always blame God for our mistakes, right?
Right.
And so looking to the father, we want to say, well, how did the father screw up that his kids are so messed up? Isn't that a way of saying, you know, God, what did you do that, you know, caused us to be such screw ups? You know, God, it's your fault. There's sin. God, if you hadn't given me this woman, I wouldn't have eaten the fruit. You know, it's placing the blame back on God, which we as humans, that's our default mode to begin with.
That
so,
is
our nature. So, you know, we can't blame the father, because, you know, anyone who's raised kids into adulthood knows that you can do all the right stuff, teach them all the right things, and still have kids that go off and do their own thing because, well, they're their own people. And, you know, I often have parents that lament, you know, Pastor, we brought them to church all the time. We taught them. They were confirmed. We showed them the importance of the faith, and now they're, you know, a bunch of godless knuckleheads, you know, doing whatever. And,
right.
You know, what did I do to screw up? And you have to remember that, you know, it's not, they've made a decision to reject what you've done, and that's exactly what, you know, the sons do. We've got a good, gracious father who lays down his life, in essence, to liquidate his assets, the farm to one boy, the money to the other. And so, you know, yes, he's reckless and extravagant, but, you know, it's his son's misinterpretation of the father's goodness that leads them to that, which is exactly the case of the Pharisees, right? They thought they were doing everything that God had commanded them to do, and yet they missed out on the fact that all God had commanded them was to point to their Savior and to their inability to save themselves, and yet look at them, they got way lost. Same with the youngest son. Ends up demanding from his father what he believes he's owed. No fault of the father's there. Son misinterprets his father's willingness to love him and allow him to do whatever the heck he wants. So, I mean, that's my take on it. At least initially.
Hey, Paul.
Okay. I think I disagree. I agree with Ross. I think, you know, our tendency is want to blame the father. The parable's not about teaching fatherhood. It's about,
sure.
Right. I mean, that's just a whole different direction.
Cause that's actually bad fatherhood, right?
Well, I think a father that is just all grace all the time, like this, will probably produce children that are a little whacked. However, you know, the lesson is that he's pleading for that son who is faithful in everything else to be faithful in his grace and his mercy and his compassion as well. And so he's to reflect what his father has. So I think as fathers, we can learn from that, you know, that, you know, the inclusion, the welcome of, you know, our children back into the fold and those kind of things, and that it should be celebrated. But it's, I think just going down that trail is going to get you.
If you're always just no questions asked, forgive, no payback, no probation, and the son, you know, there's literally no law in this. But this is just one synopsis. So in this event, he forgave. He gave the first son what he wanted. It's not like, it doesn't mean he's doing it all the time.
Yeah, I mean, he's talking to the church. I mean, your church is full of a whole bunch of older brothers who get judgy and pissed off because people come in who don't have a right to be there, right? And he forgives. So
Right. Yep. No, I think wouldn't you say that parable is only about, his focus is only on the second and the oldest son. He's talking to the Pharisees, and for the guy sitting in the church pew, for most of us, he's talking to us. Mm-hmm. If you've been in the church for a long time, the bell rang.
Yep.
All right, next topic here is
this Lenten bell obedience is getting tough.
It is hard. I know.
Killing these great topics.
So we got Holy Communion. I am doing right now. I'm doing my Lenten series is restoring the joy through. But we're going through the. It's a tricky way of getting people to go through the small catechism, 16 parts of small catechism. So we talked about Lord's Supper yesterday. What is, you know, I love to talk about the Lord's Supper, Holy Communion, Holy Eucharist, whatever. If you're wearing a collar right now. Whatever you want to call it. But to me, like, that's what separates us from our American evangelical friends and kind of American Christianity is this, what they might even call a superstitious thing where you're taking communion. What does that mean to you, Paul? What does that mean? What do you get out of that communion yourself? Does that pump you up? Thoughts on the power of Holy Communion, what it is, et cetera.
So I don't know if I would say it like pumps me up or something like that. Like I, but I think that's actually a good way to put it because
gets
I think
you
people,
off.
People, no, don't go that way. I think people view it that way or they want it to be that, right? They want it to be like this mountaintop experience.
Oh,
I mean, if you think of, the very first time you took communion, And you're like, it's a big deal. Yeah. You know, you're confirmed and all that stuff. And then you get it. And you're like, so that was it.
Steelcracker.
Huh? That's all right. Okay. You know?
Yeah. And you're like, this is what I worked on all this time. Yeah.
That was kind of anticlimactic, you know? But the thing
much
is.
Much like when I took my first LSD.
And so you end up with, you know, I think we want it to be that people because, again, I think we all seek glory. We want the big thing. We want the shiny stuff, the miracles. And and it's our Lord working through the lowly, simple things yet again. And so it's more of a habit and a ritual of assurance, right? A gift that comes outside of you for you. It is a eternal merit of God given to you. So it's something to rejoice in. But I definitely see it more as a habitual practice of the faith than like a mountaintop moment that, you know, I experience something grand each time.
Or you did experience something, but you might not emotionally react to it, but you just ate and drank the body and blood.
Yeah. No, Christ. but I mean that's a confession of the faith. But it's not like some insane. I would say this way: there are moments, right? Especially as a pastor, where you get to commune people all the time. There are moments that can be really powerful.
Yeah,
when you know somebody, like I think of it like I'll have somebody who's just lost, you know, a spouse or something like that, or recently gone through that, and you commune them, and you put your hand on their shoulder or whatever, and you can like feel.
Right.
Like it means something to them to still receive this gift. Or when you go see shut-ins and same thing, you're bringing Christ and the church to them in those moments. You know, it's powerful.
Right.
But I think for probably the vast majority of people going to communion, it's something that they confess, that they know they need. They believe they're sinners. This is for their forgiveness and they want it. But it's not, I think, overly emotive for a lot of people, you know, and that's okay. It's okay, Joel, not show emotion.
That's really good. So I was going to talk about how can we improve our reception of communion, you know, but maybe you're right. We shouldn't be encouraging people to chase some unicorn there every time, every Sunday you're taking it, you know, or doubt, you know, boy, I'm not really starting to cry, you know, when I take communion.
Worse, yeah.
Maybe. Yeah. And you're saying like, hey, first of all, as a Christian, this should become normal to you.
Yeah.
You're forgiven in a sense. Now, in one sense, you want people to like, it never to be normal. You should always be like, what the heck? I cannot believe God loves me.
Right.
It's like, it's okay to just take it, need it, and shut up.
Yeah. You know, it's like if you do baptism and you were to take away all the liturgy of our baptism, right? So you have baptism at the church, but there's none of the liturgy. And it's just the words, you know, I baptize you in the name of the Father and Holy Spirit, and you got a baby there in your hand. It is the most unimpressive looking thing, right?
Yeah.
It doesn't look fantastic. It doesn't look wonderful. It's just like, oh, that was weird. Why do we came early to church for that today? Okay, fine, you know?
Is there a temptation for baptisms, to just like you're saying, it's kind of like you really want people to just freak out, like
yeah,
and so you start talking as a pastor, you know, like
I think you do.
No, and you say stuff.
Yeah,
no one cares, or you're leading them astray, maybe even by not. Now, if the Fort Wayners would be like, yeah, you shouldn't see anything because you don't want any emotion at all. It's all the Lord's, blah blah blah. You know, but you can go that way. That's funny. What do you think, Ross?
You know, it's interesting. You talk about things people do to try and spruce up something that God has done. You know, I once read somewhere that the real miracle in Holy Communion isn't that Jesus' body and blood are present, but that cheap wine and that sad excuse for bread is actually bread and wine. You know, that's the bigger miracle. Yeah. and you know, it's true. You know, we use these humble things, you know, water from the tap, cheap gallon jug of wine and bread that's hardly bread, and yet God works through these things to accomplish his purposes, and what awesomeness is there. The problem is when people try and chase the cool or the innovative, you know. There's when our kids were baptized, we were asked by my in-laws if we wanted the Jordan River water for the babies, because I guess decades ago, my grandfather-in-law went to the Holy Land and got a jar of water from the Jordan River that he himself filled up, and they keep it in the freezer for baptisms. And and I remember my wife asking me that, and I'm like, oh, hell no, we're just using regular water. I don't want, I don't want that dirty water first to begin with. And then second off, I didn't want my kids to go through life at some point and be like, oh, well, you know, we were baptized in Jordan River water. Right. And, you know, that's more special than the water that you guys were baptized in. And I've heard people talk that way. You know, I had a Lutheran once tell me that while they don't believe in second baptisms, they did go and get rebaptized in the Jordan River because it's just so cool to be there where Jesus was baptized. I'm like, no, that's not cool.
You should have said that. You know that water that Jesus was baptized in is nowhere near the Jordan River at this point.
Right.
I mean, it's like probably somewhere out in the Atlantic Ocean.
Yep. Yeah. Probably somewhere out there.
Yeah,
But people will do that, chasing that cool thing. And I had to sit through a district presentation once from some jack wagon that tried to convince us that communion at his church was much more than just the communion that everybody else had, because he had some folks that were really spiritually aware. I guess in today's parlance, we'd say they were spiritually woke. What? And they could sense that there were angels, that they could actually sense the angels were present at communion.
Lutheran Church of Missouri Synod.
Oh, yeah, this was one of those Pentecostal Lutheran guys. And he's like, oh, yeah, we can sense the angels. They're flying around while we're there. And we've had some members that have seen them. And so our communion is truly special at our church because the angels are present and the people see them and feel them.
And
I'm like, what kind of, I mean, I had to go to this mandatory thing for put on by the district to learn about this. I was like, oh, this is just crap. People are looking for something cool that they can grasp onto. And God's like,
Right.
I'm working through these humble means, and you can take what I'm offering you, or you can leave it. And if you leave it, you're screwed. But this is how I'm working. So take it and believe. But it's never good enough. We want the mountaintop experience. We want the national youth gathering. Yep. We're not good enough for our regular Sunday church, right? I mean, we need something We need the experience of the mountaintop.
Right. Yep. So when you guys brought this up before
beach
the
balls
episode,
and church and stuff,
I got curious and I actually started reading the Luther's Large Catechism, which was a mistake. Mm.
Whoa.
Yeah,
but this,
now
is,
you're
this
really
is what it says.
You know, I think in my large catechism until I went to seminary there, Tyler, it sounds
yeah,
to me
I got
like
it
you're well
Google.
On your way to get off to seminary.
I got it on the internet. So, but what it says is, it says, now this is all that's required of a Christian as preparation to receive the sacrament worthily. For since this treasure is offered in words, it can be grasped and appropriated only by the heart. Such a gift and eternal blessing cannot be seized by the hand. Fasting and prayer and like things may have their place as an external preparation and youthful discipline. There are many also reverential and modest bodily attitudes towards the body and blood of Christ. However, that which is given in and with our sacrament cannot be grasped nor appropriated by the body. It is accomplished by faith in the heart, which discerns this treasure and desires it. This is sufficient for all mm-hmm. ordinary instruction of the Lord's Supper.
Yeah. Boom. That's it. Yeah. Rip out all your small catechism extra pages and just have the small catechism and the large catechism, and you're fine.
And then it also says, this: whatever remains to be said on this appropriate is more appropriate for another occasion. And then he goes on for about seven more pages talking about the communion.
Pope. Okay, yeah.
Well, it's
that's
Luther,
awesome.
So.
It's good. Every word, a morsel. A beautiful, tasty morsel in the large catechism, for goodness sakes.
Yeah, oh, yeah.
Hey, what about, I don't know why. Oh, yeah, speaking of asinine people in the cloth, in the pulpit, this is a quote from, Greg Griffith, pastor of a church in Michigan. He puts this on his page. It says, "Praise is the highway. Praise is the highway to the throne of God. Praise is the highway to the heart of God. Praise is the highway to the move of God. Purpose of our life is praise." What the hell is that?
It's called mysticism, right?
Yeah, right.
That's what it is, right? Like I'm gonna soar up to God on my praise.
That's what I'm reading here.
That's called sowing seeds of doubt in the hearts and minds of your believers who think, boy, I don't think I'm doing this well enough. Maybe I need to, you know, work a little harder so that I can get on that highway to God, make it happen.
That's right. I mean, we're talking about communion. We're talking about baptism, things that Jesus told us connects us to God.
Yeah,
therefore, I would say, right?
Isn't that from the Westminster Catechism? The Westminster Catechism that says the chief purpose of man is to glorify God?
Yes.
You know, so
one could say that, but what does that mean? You got to flesh that out.
Yeah.
You know? And I think people think
so
that means
just
raising
a Westminster
hands and praising God.
But see, what Joel just read is worse than that. Westminster Catechism is saying, right, this is what you're on the earth to do. That's what they're arguing, right? Is to
you take communion
God.
By you, right? Yeah, and you glorify God when you take communion.
But this other guy that Joel just read, that guy's saying this is how you're gonna get to God, right? You're gonna praise your way to Him
hard. what does that even mean?
I don't
know. What does that even look like?
I'm sure they. See, it's the thing. You show up on Sunday morning, and I'll show you, right? I mean, this isn't rocket science. This is, man, do you want to grow your church? You want to get close to God, man? You come to my church, and I will show you how to navigate that highway so you can get close to God, and I can get a hot tub and a private jet because those things are necessary.
Not going to lie, AC/DC makes the highway to hell sound a lot more fun.
I would much rather go to a church that plays that. So that's just, I mean,
I'm looking at this dude's page. Now I'm at this dude's page and you can love others only if you love yourself.
What is going on?
This is not Lutheran.
You're right. That's right. That's right. All right. Praise is the highway.
I don't even know what that topic
is. The highway. No,
I had to just say it.
I think we need a new topic of just let's scroll
call
Facebook and call out that theology.
I think we need to do that.
And
again, kids,
and now it's time for
don't do this.
Theology.
This is too much. This is too much, right? I mean, this is not like, oh, I don't want to be picky. No, that's insane. That's outrageous. Right. That's Satan's work. Anyhow. Mm-hmm. We will conclude with, I'm sorry, let's talk about Palm Sunday a little bit real quick, and then I got a nice poem here from G.K. Chesterton. So Palm Sunday's coming up, as some people call it, Palm Sunday, what do they call it, the Cross Sunday, or Suffering Passion, the Passion Sunday. And I think originally it's Palm Sunday, and then I think because we feel like no one's going to come to any Holy Week stuff, then we start to cram in Passion Story, right?
You're wrong.
What is it?
Nope.
What is it?
No, from what I can tell, it was originally Passion Sunday. And the palm portion was always a pre-service thing.
Oh, sorry. Okay. Oh, so, really? Yeah. So you're talking about
always, yeah.
Long time. Okay.
Yeah.
That's so how
you're talking
I like
since
to do
back
it.
In the day?
I'm talking back when the pilgrims first started going to Jerusalem to reenact all this stuff.
Okay.
The palm processional was done before the service. So the service wasn't palm Sunday. Like that was the pre-service palm.
Sure.
Yeah.
All right. And then the service. And so, you know, you can still maintain that today. But I think most of us grew up, I know I did, where it was just Palm Sunday. And
same
we
here,
read
right.
the triumphant entry in the church, and that's all there was to it. But traditionally, it was bigger than that.
So the palm stuff, maybe what happened is this palm stuff's just cool. I don't want to stop talking about it. And it's, you know what I mean? It's visuals. You got palms.
Well, I think it's, it is cool. But then it became, you know, well, let's not do it before the service. Let's just do it as the service.
There
you
go. Yeah.
I mean, you can see how it gets there pretty
quick.
Which
is fine. Quite honestly, if you're out there doing just Palm Sunday, God bless you. If you're just doing Passion Sunday, good for you. If you're doing both, kudos. You get the Greg Griffith
bonus
Award.
Point. Yeah.
Greg Griff Award is what you get right there.
Guess is he's doing neither. He's just doing
Saber
Palm Sunday.
Saber of boldness. I probably know.
Saber of boldness.
Boy, fitting everyone today, Joe.
I think I'm going to get that because I tell you what, we're doing, we do our Palm Sunday processional outside into the sanctuary.
The
we do a pause and then we go into Passion. Well, of course you're doing Christmas, Joel, didn't you for your last Sunday at your last church, didn't you do Palm Sunday and you rode in on a donkey and they all waved palm branches and said goodbye to you?
I mean, that's exactly right. That's right.
See,
that's
I knew it.
College
no,
place.
He said that he rode in on a jackass, and I carried him in piggyback style.
Hey, you know, the message of Palm Sunday is if Jesus can get his ass to church, so can you, right?
Okay.
I thought that was Ash Wednesday.
Ash Wednesday.
Okay. Yeah. What's so usually for this message, you know, it's I think it's fun to do that juxtaposition of the king and the king on the cross, the king in glory, king on the cross. Which Jesus is it? And I've done Mary's perspective. You know, she's sitting there at the cross, and she's wondering what the heck happened from her our hopes and dreams. Now crushed, seemingly. Ross, what do you like to get out of this Palm Sunday, Passion Sunday juxtaposition here?
I like to get out a quick sermon before I have to get into, like, the Holy Week festivities. I think there's a good juxtaposition there, because what we want when it comes to a savior, it's just a fun word to say. What we want when it comes to a savior is the triumphant entry, Jesus, right? We want the one that comes and doesn't have to suffer and everybody loves. Wouldn't it be great if everybody loved Christians and our message? But what we end up getting is actually the suffering servant, the one who hangs and dies on a cross, and it's not pretty, and it's not attractive, and it's offensive on so many levels. And yet this is what we get from God, right? God works in such a way that's offensive. Simple water, simple bread, simple wine, a Jewish man, true God, true man, nailed to a cross, that's salvation. And it's offensive because that's not what we expect, that's not what we want. And yet this is how God chooses to reconcile his creation to us. He doesn't respond to sinful humanity and their rebellion by mounting a war horse to come in to destroy them, but mounts a beast of burden to come in and suffer and die for them when we're the ones that deserve death. And so that's what I like to typically point out, I think, in a Palm Sunday type of sermon, Palm Sunday, Passion Sunday, blend them in, make it work.
All right, we're at the bell there. I can't believe that was, that seemed kind of short, Paul.
That was kind of short bell. I think we should extend that bell.
No, I can't go beyond the bell.
Obey the bell.
Keeping my Lenten vow.
I like it. All right. Yeah. Yeah. When fishes flew and forests walked and figs grew upon thorn, some moment when the moon was blood, then surely I was born. With monstrous head and sickening cry and ears like errant wings, the devil's walking parody on all four-footed things. The tattered outlaw of the earth of ancient crooked will, starved, scourged to ride me, I am dumb. I keep my secret still. Fools, for I also had my hour, one far fierce hour and sweet. There was a shout about my ears and palms before my feet. The donkey, G.K. Chesterton. I think we assume he's talking about Palm Sunday, but maybe not. All right, we're glad to have you with us. And Paul, how are we doing on the Craft of Preaching deal?
Oh, thanks for bringing that up. I think there's still spots available. I'll be talking with Bob this afternoon to confirm that. So, if you are listening to this and you want to go to Chicago June 3rd to the 5th, it should be an excellent time. If you're a pastor, you want to be there. Your preaching will get better, I promise you, if you go.
Amen.
So go to craftofpreaching.com. Up at the top, there's a little black bar up there. It says something about the workshop. Click on that and register, and we'll see you in June.
Simultaneously, Greg Griffith is having a praise seminar, how to praise better, what words to say and stuff like that. So if you're interested in that, so that's at the same time. So got to make a choice.
Yep.
So, hey, have we
offended
anybody?
I'm going to be hearing from him.
I doubt he listens to this. Have we offended anybody?
Yeah, we have. First of all, I need to apologize to my mom again for last week's episode because she hasn't heard it yet. But
I did hear that. That's pretty
bad.
I'm going
to get my ass kicked.
Yes.
Yes. Also, 1517 Legacy Podcast Network. The many people that I no doubt missed on this list because I got distracted reading Luther's Large Catechism. Zion Williamson, ESPN, Duke, the rest of the media, pastors, people who do their jobs that are not pastors. Julie Hess, the prodigal son, his brother, his dad. All dads, Fort Wayne seminarians, Alicia Engel, some jackwagon that Ross listened to, Pentecostal Lutheran seminarians, Greg Griffith, his congregation, Westminster Catechism, Julie Hess, ACDC, The View, G.K. Chesterton, Emmanuel Cadillac, Ross's congregation, Cindy Koch, and Greg Griffith again.
All right. Not sorry about the Greg Griffith thing. Okay,
he's got a whole bunch
news.
Of publicity.
Yeah. That's right. Good man.
Peace.
Listen, time, yes, I am. As the people all collide and the Nazi genocide starts to end, complacent mind, yes, I am. And the blankless stares from France, and the narcissistic dares come to an end. It's the end. From laughing by the tents, eating ice cream in the Benz, it's alright. Don't worry about those people in your